Yale Podcast Network.
Welcome to the McMillan Report. I'm Marilyn Wilkshire, host, and our guest is Robin Creswell, an associate professor of comparative literature at Yale. He studies modern Arabic literature, the practice of literary translation, art and revolution, and modernist poetry in French, English, and Spanish, and Arabic. His writings have appeared in The New Yorker, The New York Review of Books, and Harper's Magazine, among many other publications. Today we'll talk with Professor Creswell about his new book, City of Beginnings, Poetic Modernism in Beirut, for which he was recently awarded the Macmillan Center's Gaddis Smith International Book Prize for Best First Book. Welcome, Professor Creswell.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Let's start with an overview of your book. Tell us about it.
So the book is a study of a modernist movement, the modernist movement in Arabic poetry, which is a movement that happens in Beirut, the capital of Lebanon, between the end of World War II and about 1975, when the Civil War begins in Lebanon. And I think one could make the argument, I would make the argument, that this is really the most important, most influential artistic movement in the Arab world since World War II. I think the poets of this movement really fundamentally changed the understanding of what poetry is, what its audience is, how it relates to that audience, and how it relates to its classical past, as well as how it fits into the wider landscape of modern poetry in the world. So it's a look at that movement in particular, and I focus on the work of poets like Adonis, who is a Syrio-Lebanese poet who is still alive. A man named Yusuf Al-Khal, who was an editor of the magazine that I focus on, and some other poets and critics as well. It's also a book about it's about Lebanon during this period, and Beirut in particular, when Lebanon really occupies a slightly anomalous or unique position in Arab intellectual landscape. It's the moment, it's kind of the golden age for Beirut, when a lot of intellectuals from Egypt, Syria, Iraq, are fleeing from an increasingly sort of monolithic political culture in those places, and they come to Beirut, which is kind of overflowing with magazines and films from abroad, and has a very weak state, and therefore a very weak censorship. And so they have a sort of intellectual freedom to work in this, to elaborate a kind of modernist movement. So it's a book about what modernism means, what artistic modernism means in Beirut during its golden era.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious what led you to write the book. I know you do study a lot of different kinds of poetry, but why this?
Well, in large part, it just had to do with my feeling that this is really the most fascinating artistic movement, and they produced some great poetry. I mean, it has to do with a kind of feeling, aesthetic feeling on my part, that this is wonderful poems and something that I could imagine myself working on for, you know, 6 or 7 years and not getting bored and continuing to learn. So that was the basis of it. I also feel like this obviously very important movement, while it's been quite well studied, insofar as any modern Arabic poetry has been quite well studied, has not been helpfully placed in an international context. I mean, these were poets who really thought one of the things that modernism means for them is a kind of cosmopolitan or internationalist outlook on culture. So the magazine that I focus on, which is called Sha'r magazine, which means poetry magazine, which is a name that they took from Harriet Monroe's little magazine of the same name, which is still published in Chicago. One of the things that they thought modernity meant, al-hadatha in Arabic, is an internationalist outlook. So this magazine published an immense amount of translations from particularly English and French 20th century poetry, but also German poetry and Spanish poetry. So Whitman and Lorca and Octavio Paz and Saint-Jean Perse and Yves Bonnefoy and T.S. Eliot and Pound. So it was an amazingly cosmopolitan sort of group. And so I try to take that fact seriously and think about, you know, what placing this movement, this very important Arabic movement, in a much wider intellectual context can help us, how it can help us understand that movement. And I also had the feeling that, I mean, I work in a comparative literature department, and I feel like this is a moment when comparatists are beginning to understand that really comparative literature has not had a very wide remit, historically speaking, in terms of the literature that it looks at. It's mostly been looking at European and American literatures. And I think that by looking at a movement which is so cosmopolitan and internationalist and placing it in that sort of context, it can also help comparative literature studies kind of deprovincialize itself and see what it can learn by looking at, you know, a corpus of literature that really has been, for the most part, neglected.
Mm-hmm. So in looking at the poetry in Beirut, how would you say it compares to the other poetry that was being done in the Middle East during that time, and then as well as in the Western world? What are some of the similarities, if there were any, and differences?
So the movement that I'm looking at, this modernist movement in Beirut, had a very antagonistic relationship with poets and intellectuals elsewhere in the region. The region meaning essentially the three other major intellectual capitals, which would be Cairo, Damascus, and Baghdad. And so, as I say, Beirut occupied a kind of unique place within this geography. Broadly speaking, I would say poets and intellectuals in those other countries, Egypt, Syria, and Iraq, were struggling with how to think about the relationship between intellectuals and newly independent post-colonial states. They were, for the most part, nationalist intellectuals of one sort or another, be it a kind of local nationalist, Egyptian nationalism or Iraqi nationalism or pan-Arab nationalism, or they were Marxists. And so they thought that the relationship between poetry or culture and politics should be a very close one, that they were engagé intellectuals. And so the notion of engagement, which comes very directly from Sartre, is a kind of intellectual orthodoxy at this moment in the 50s, 60s, and up into the 70s, where the poet views him or herself as being engaged in political questions very explicitly. And so the poets that I'm looking at, part of what they also meant by modernism was not just a kind of cosmopolitan internationalist outlook. They also insisted that poetry and politics should have nothing to do with one another, that culture should be the space of absolute freedom and questioning, and that the state in particular should have no role in deciding or imposing itself upon the intellectual class. And so this was the idea that, you know, poetry should be self-sufficient or autonomous is, I think, a kind of intellectual commonplace of the post-World War II period outside the Middle East, especially in Europe and America, where basically, this is, of course, remembered during the early Cold War period, American and allied intellectuals in Europe are basically making this argument that, you know, what is the role of culture in this moment? Well, it has to be a space of freedom. It has to be free from state control, because we don't want to be like those poets and intellectual workers in the Second World, in the Soviet Union or its allies, where the state gets to decide what you ought to think. So those are the very broad parameters, I think, of like Cold War intellectual culture in which these Arab movements situate themselves.
Okay, and what were some of these poets in Beirut actually writing about? Was it love? Was it death? You know, what were the general topics that they were looking at?
Yeats says that there are only really two subjects for poetry, which are sex and death.
Okay.
And I think he's, broadly speaking, he's probably right. No, they do. They write love poetry. They write. They do write a lot of elegies. Actually, I mean, speaking about death, it's one of the things that I look at in the book is the ways in which the tradition of the genre of elegy in Arabic is an extremely old one. It goes back to the pre-Islamic period, and I have a chapter in the book in particular about the way that Adonis understands the writing of elegies. One of the things that he does that's very odd is that he writes a lot of elegies for classical poets, that is to say Arab poets who live in the 8th, 9th, 12th centuries. What does it mean to write an elegy for somebody who's been dead for a millennium or more? And so anyway, one of the things that I argue in that chapter is that as opposed to the way we usually think of elegiac poetry, which is a poetry of feelings, of emotion, really what he's doing in those poems is kind of constructing a genealogy of poets. So by elegizing, by mourning the death of this long dead poet, one of the things that he's doing is trying to construct a kind of a modernist, in fact, genealogy of poets that stretch back into the early portions of the Arabic poetry, thereby suggesting that, in fact, Arabic poetry has its own sort of modernist stream that goes back for a very long time, and that it's not merely this contemporary sort of movement. So they write elegies, they write a lot of love poetry, they write, Adonis, another thing that I talk about in the book, he writes a lot of poems that have to do with kind of travel, an itinerary that he keeps on obsessively retracing from how he got from Damascus to Beirut and what sort of meanings that sort of journey had. So they write about the sorts of things that, in one sense, poets have always written about, but they do it with a particular purpose.
Okay. And how did you do the research for the book, and did you encounter any surprises or things you didn't necessarily expect as you were exploring the body of work?
So most of this is a literary, it's for the most part literary criticism, and most of the research involved reading old magazines and books of poetry. Mm-hmm. I did go to the library at the American University in Beirut to look at some old newspapers from the 40s and 50s. I also did go to the University of Chicago Special Collections, which is where the archive of the Congress for Cultural Freedom is housed. The Congress for Cultural Freedom was a front group for the CIA, for the American CIA, which during the immediate post-war period set up a whole umbrella of highbrow literary magazines, among them the most famous one being Encounter in Britain, but also in just about any other country you can imagine, especially in Europe. It was a kind of Marshall Plan for the intellectual class. Mm-hmm. So Preuve and Dermonat and Mundo Nuevo, they had this whole network of magazines that they set up. And they also sponsored conferences all over the world. And this was their attempt to kind of woo, at first European, but then also Asian, African, Middle Eastern intellectuals to their way of thinking about cultural freedom. Mm-hmm. One of the conferences that they set up, a rather infamous conference, at least if you're interested in Arabic poetry, was held in Rome in 1961, and it was a conference about the modern Arabic literature and the world literature, in fact. And all of the poets that I study were present at this conference, which was hosted by Stephen Spender, the British poet, and Ignazio Silone, the famous Italian novelist. And this conference has been kind of pointed to by critics of the modernist group as being proof that they were basically supported by and in cahoots with the Central Intelligence Agency. No, but people did not know at the time, of course, that it was being funded, although there were lots of rumors about it. And so this was a real accusations and counter-accusations went back and forth during all throughout the 1960s about whether or not this modernist group in Beirut was actually a kind of playing footsie with American imperialism. So that was one of the things I wanted to discover by going back to this, and it's a very interesting and complicated story. Basically, they, for interesting reasons, could not come to this conference in Rome was a kind of audition for the Arab poets to say, is there some space for us to negotiate and come to an agreement about publishing a magazine in Beirut? In the end, they did not come to an agreement, and they did not publish with that group, with the group that I'm concerned with. They did publish a magazine. It was called Hawad. It was out of Beirut, but it was not the poets that I'm looking at who really ran that show. So I was able to, however, find out that some early issues of the magazine did receive funding from the Congress for Cultural Freedom, and that was unexpected. Mm-hmm.
Why do you think Beirut was at the center of this modern poetry? I don't know if the word explosion would be correct to use in this instance.
Yeah. Well, I think that Beirut and Lebanon in general had a somewhat unusual relationship to the whole concept of, or the whole discourse on modernity. And it was a positive one. I think that the intellectual class was in general somewhat like Singapore a little bit later. They were open to modernity as a kind of way of opening up the economy, of opening up artistic life to currents from abroad, to international styles of thinking. And it was very valued. It was so the poets that I'm looking at were in some ways very very mainstream to Lebanese intellectual life, even if they were not so, even if they were antagonistically related to other streams of Arab life at the moment. I also think that, as I mentioned before, the peculiarity of Beirut is that it had a very weak state. Mm-hmm. This is for historical reasons. The French, which was the imperial power in Lebanon, what was not yet called Lebanon during the mandate period between the wars. Basically, it was the poorer of the two imperial powers, Britain and France in the region, and it ran the mandate on a kind of shoestring budget. So it starved the state of a lot of resources. Also, Lebanon is a country with lots of different confessional groups, and Druze, Maronite Christians, Shias and Sunnis, Armenians, and the leaders of those communities were often happy not to have the state take over things like education and health services. So they were happy to also starve the state in some ways, or keep it from becoming very powerful. So one of the knock-on effects of this history is that, as I said, censorship laws were relatively low. Mm-hmm. And so there was a burgeoning and very lively civil society, in the sense that there were journals, there were newspapers, and they fought with each other. They didn't tow the state's party line, even mm-hmm. if they were towing one or the other confessional group's party line, let's say. So there was a kind of effervescence to intellectual life during this period that had to do with the peculiar history of Lebanon itself.
Mm-hmm. And poetry, though, was hugely popular among all different classes of people there in Lebanon, yes, which is somewhat unusual compared to other countries.
Well, I would say even more broadly than that, you know, poetry is the oldest Arab art form we have, really. I mean, we have poems from the pre-Islamic period. So it's a form with a 1500 year history behind it. And so it's a kind of the queen of the arts, and it has been, so that when the Arab Spring occurred in 2011, it was not terribly surprising that the great slogan of that moment, "Shab yurid isqat al-nizam," the people want the downfall of the regime, is actually taken, borrowed from, adapted from a poem by a Tunisian poet named Abu Qasim Shabbi. Because poetry has this tremendous aura and status as both an art form with a long history, as well as contemporary resonance, as well as popular following, as well as a popular audience. And that's something that I think it takes a little while for Americans to wrap their heads around, that this is a form that, while it was, I think, entering into a kind of moment of crisis after World War II, and that crisis has continued, it is still a form which had great status and great elite literary status, as well as a popular audience. And in some ways, we can only think about somebody like, you know, Shakespeare enjoying in our own culture.
Mm-hmm. When you're reading the poems, I imagine, of course, they're in Arabic.
Yes.
What was it like for you to, and I obviously know you read Arabic, how was it like to think about the poetry while written in Arabic, but translating it into English? Was that very difficult?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, it's I do a lot of translating in the book because I do close readings of poems, and to do those close readings, one has to have the text there next to you. And of course, you're writing your commentary in English, but you're writing about a poem that has been written in Arabic, so you have to kind of signpost the translation with the Arabic words that you might be talking about. And it's very tricky, and you have to be very careful about, or choosy about, which poems you're going to look closely at, because you also, I also want, you know, part of the stakes of the book, I would say, is to persuade possibly skeptical American or English language readers that this is a great poetical tradition, and it's something that we can learn from, and it's interesting for us to read. So I did want to choose poems that I thought are great poems, that are interesting, and then also have something to say, you know, that I can say clearly and cleanly about the way the language works. Mm-hmm. So I think you have to be, I think you just have to be especially careful about what texts you choose, because you have to be able to explain the enormous intricacy of what's going on in the Arabic in English.
Right, right. And a lot of times there are some words that there are simply no English words for, correct?
You mean like untranslatable sorts of words? I'm not a great fan of the idea of untranslatability, I have to say. I mean, I think that all words are in some ways translatable. There are certain words that maybe need paraphrasing rather than strict one-to-one sorts of correspondence. I mean, that is true. But I don't think the translation is really captured by the idea of substituting a word in one language for a word in another language. I think really the units of sense and aesthetic sense that we're talking about when we talk about doing translation are much broader than merely a word, which we might very well have no equivalent for in English. Okay. So there are words that I talk about in the book, like the word tarab is the most famous one of these. Tarab, which means something like musical ecstasy, the feeling of musical ecstasy which is shared between a performer and an audience. And it becomes a very important word for discussing notions of meter and music in modernist poetry versus more traditional poetry. So how to translate tarab is a question I look at very briefly. But I think in the end, if commentary is also doing the work of translation, I think, you know, that's just your job.
Right, right. Okay, good. So what would you like your reader to take away from your book?
Well, I would like them to, as I was saying, you know, I'd like them to take away the idea that this is an immensely interesting, rich corpus of poetry that probably most American readers are unfamiliar with. I also hope that, you know, those who are interested in poetry, generally speaking, by looking at this particular movement, might learn to look at the texts and verse that they are more familiar with new eyes.
Mm-hmm. Okay, wonderful. Thank you so much for being here with us today and sharing your work.
It was a pleasure.
For more information about Professor Cresswell and his research, please visit our website at macmillanreport.yale.edu. Be sure to join us again for another episode of the Macmillan Report, made possible through funding from the Whitney and Betty Macmillan Center for International and Area Studies at Yale.